WMFO Medford.
Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 28th of December, 2022. My name is Arthur, and this is the grand hour here on 91.5 FM. I have a guest in the studio this morning, little Arthur. So first, we're going to get to the radio dramas. I'm going to start things off with the Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. This is going to be a quarter hour episode. It's going to be bookend Six Shooter in the middle of the set with the Chesapeake fraud matter. This had an original air date of the 17th of October, 1955.
From Hollywood, it's time now for Bob Bailey as...
Johnny Dollar.
Hi. Pat Kelleher, Universal Adjustment Bureau.
Good to hear your voice, Patsy. Thought you were transferred to Baltimore.
That's where I am. Say, John, can you handle one for me?
What kind of one?
It's a life and accident policy. Eastern Fidelity paid off 5 years ago. A man named John Reardon was the insured party. He died in 1950. Wife was a beneficiary. It's a crazy one.
Well, go on.
Eastern wants us to look into the matter QT. One of their officers has reason to believe Reardon is still alive.
Why would he think that?
Because he saw him 2 days ago.
I'll get the first plane.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Universal Adjustment Bureau, Baltimore, Maryland. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Chesapeake fraud matter. Expense account item 1, $22.75, plane fare and incidentals, Hartford to Baltimore. I arrived at 3:15 in the afternoon at Friendship International Airport. It was a cold, gray day. I took a cab directly to Pat Kelleher's office.
Good to see you, John.
He was 10 pounds heavier. Outside of that, he looked swell.
We'll have to have dinner once you meet my wife. Where are your bags? You didn't go to a hotel.
I checked my stuff at the airport, Patsy. I didn't know how long I'd be here. Over the Alleghenies on the plane, I got to thinking about the number of alive but dead reports I've investigated at one time or another. They happen all the time, but they never pan out.
Yeah, well, this one isn't like that, John. Sit down.
Thanks.
You know, when a man like Paul Coombs, chairman of the board for Eastern Fidelity, not to mention vice president of two oil companies and one construction company, when he romps in here and says somebody's still alive, it's supposed to be dead, we got to listen to him.
Sure you do, Pat. It's your job.
Your job now. Coombs claims he not only saw Reardon, but talked to him. I'll go into that later. Policy was issued in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's a beneficiary.
Yeah. Elizabeth Jane Reardon, $10,000.
20, John. Double indemnity on the accident clause.
Oh. Well, look, I'll look at this stuff later. Maybe you better tell me about that first.
Okay. John Reardon was lost in a boat accident out on Chesapeake Bay.
When?
August 13th, 1950. There were four people in the party. They went out for the afternoon on a power cruiser, and the thing exploded in the middle of the bay.
Yeah, I may have read about it. Was there a man named Sharpston involved?
Yeah. Sharpston owned the boat. He and his wife were aboard, and another man named Blaine.
Did all of them go down?
That's right. They recovered Mr. and Mrs. Sharpston's body and Blaine's. They never found John Reardon.
What caused the explosion?
No explainable reason. It was never determined.
Oh, there's always a reason.
Yeah, well, that probably blew up with the boat, too. As it happened, we conducted the investigation for Atlantic States Limited. They held the insurance on the Sharpstons and the boat. These are our findings in the matter. We found no reason for Atlantic not to honor the claim made by Sharpstone's estate.
Mm-hmm. How about the other man who was killed, Blaine?
His case was adjusted by another company.
So that leaves us John Reardon.
Yeah. About a month after the accident, his wife filed claim for payment. Our investigation was ended by then. We notified the insurance commission of the circumstances of his death and requested a judgment.
Routine. Did it go through all right?
Yeah. The appellate court declared John Reardon legally dead after the required 3-year waiting period. Pretty standard when there's no body.
Sure.
Eastern honored the claim and paid Mrs. Reardon $20,000. So, that's about it.
Except that now somebody thinks he's alive.
Not just somebody. Paul Coombs.
Yeah, yeah. And if that's so, Eastern's been swindled for $20,000. Tell me about the beneficiary.
Ms. Reardon?
Mm-hmm.
Nice woman. Met her a couple of times. She didn't need money, I can tell you that much.
Oh?
Yeah, worth over $200,000. Never married again.
You say she didn't file her claim until a month after the accident.
That's right.
She ever give any reason for waiting that long?
Well, she was pretty broken up about it. The money wasn't important particularly. Maybe she just forgot.
Pat, I've got a question.
What's that, John?
How can you forget $20,000? Expense account item 2, $10, for drinks I had with Pat Kelleher while we talk some more about the Reardon case. At 7 o'clock that night, I had on a fresh shirt and a press suit. They seemed to impress Paul Coombs, vice president, chairman of boards, etc.
Dollar?
That's right, Mr. Coombs, Universal Adjustment.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. Come in, come in. I talked to Mr. Kelleher there. He sent you?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, I recall your name now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we can sit here, Mr. Dollar. Now, you hear about John Reardon, of course.
That's right.
I'm glad they sent a man like you. I'm glad you're the one who's going to look into it.
You puzzle me, Mr. Coombs.
No, I don't. And that's a compliment to your perceptive abilities, young man. As a matter of fact, you're here because you're only curious about me. You want to have a look at the man who thinks he saw John Reardon alive, right?
I suppose so.
You don't believe he is alive?
I didn't say that.
I admire your caution. I'm glad you're the one who's going to look into it because, well, John Reardon was a close friend of mine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, I knew him for a number of years, and Mrs. Reardon. He was a fine, sensitive man. I'm sure you'll know how to handle him when you meet him.
You sound very certain that I will meet him, Mr. Coombs.
There's no doubt in my mind about that. 3 nights ago at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver, Colorado, I saw John Reardon. I walked up and spoke to him. I talked with him for 15 or 20 minutes. I know it was him.
He didn't admit it.
He denied it completely. He told me his name was Frank Bauer and that he had lived in Denver ever since the war.
Frank Bauer?
Yes. I was so certain it was John Reardon, I insisted. He laughed at me. Seemed good-natured about it. Even bought me a drink.
I see.
I asked him where he had lived before Denver. He said something about Toledo.
Uh-huh.
I asked him if he'd gone to college there. He told me he'd gone to Ohio State. He told me he was an engineer, a mining engineer. Everything he told me seemed plausible and reasonable, except that all the time I knew he was lying. I knew his name wasn't Frank Bowers. That was John Reardon.
How did you leave it with him?
Well, the whole thing unnerved me somewhat. I'm afraid I looked like rather a fool. I simply caught my limousine out of the airport and came back here to Baltimore.
Did you get his address in Denver?
No.
Any of his business connections, anything like that?
No.
Was he alone when you met him?
There was no one with him. At the bar, he even ordered his drink the way John always ordered it. You know, like this.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people make that signal for 2 fingers of bourbon.
Wore clothes the same way, too.
Have you spoken of this matter to anyone outside of Pat Kelleher?
No. No, I thought it should be looked into before I called up Elizabeth.
Elizabeth?
Elizabeth Reardon, John's widow.
Oh, yes.
It'll do no good bothering her just now.
I'm afraid she'll have to be bothered.
Why? Can't you investigate the information I've given you without upsetting everyone?
With this kind of information, somebody's bound to get upset. Look, don't put restrictions on me, Mr. Coombs, or we won't get anywhere. You say John Reardon was a close friend of yours.
Yes.
I presume his wife was, too.
That's right. A lovely, lovely person.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind when I talk to her.
Maybe you aren't the man for this.
You can get somebody else, Mr. Coombs.
No, no, no. It's just that I suddenly had a strange feeling about it all. Depressing.
If John Reardon is alive, and you seem to be certain of it, then I understand your feeling.
How's that?
Your friend's party to a $20,000 fraud, not to mention his wife. Possibly he's not as sensitive and she's not as lovely as you thought. I spent the rest of the evening with Pat Kelleher and his wife, hoping to see the bright lights and listen to some laughter. We picked a couple of fancy bistros and started the rounds to watch champagne flow and eavesdrop on the happy stories of success, promotion, and love. But it didn't work.
Like the place, John?
It's swell.
You're as low as a cricket's ankle.
Well, today a man kept telling me a friend of his was alive who's supposed to be dead. He told me what a fine fella this friend is, or was.
Yeah.
99 times out of 100, I tell him to go jump in the lake, but Paul Coombs comes under the title Reliable Witness in anybody's book. Give me a match.
Here. How you fix for plans?
Start somebody looking into Frank, whatever his name is, in Denver, who's supposed to be Reardon. I'll start with a beneficiary, but...
Miss Reardon?
Yeah. I'll march out and say, let me look at some pictures of your husband. What kind of a guy was he? Did you enjoy each other or try to kill each other? Did you ever, why didn't Coombs look into it himself? Why didn't he go out to the widow and tell her about his meeting the guy in Denver?
Because he came to us, John.
Yeah, I know, Patsy. I'm sorry. But the prospect of going to somebody, anybody, with a flimsy story like that makes me sore. It might get her hopes up that her husband's alive. And that's a lousy thing to do. Reliable or not, Coombs is probably all wet.
Probably.
Sour racket.
Sour racket.
You being a parrot?
Just being agreeable, John. If you want to be sad, I'll be sad with you. We both know situations like this are part of the trade.
Oh, I should have been a... Oh, let's have another belt.
Sure. Waiter. Well, John,
Maybe
another way to handle Mrs. Reardon with that. That's her over there at the bar. Nice, isn't she?
Hey, she is lovely.
Nothing.
She looks a little tight.
Yeah, well, I hear she gets that way quite a bit these days. Say, John, you want me to introduce you like a friend? It might make it easier.
No, I'll handle it myself. Who's with her?
Beats me.
He's looking for a phone booth. Pat.
Yeah?
I may be able to find out what I want and not let her know what it's about.
You mean right now?
I mean right now. Hello. You're Elizabeth Reardon, aren't you?
Why, yes.
Oh, probably you don't remember me. My name's Johnny Dollar. We met some time ago.
I'm afraid I don't remember, Mr. Dollar.
I'm in the insurance business. Don't remember?
Well, where was it we met?
No, I can't remember. May I sit down?
Well, I'm expecting someone. He'll be back in a minute. Yes.
Would you care for a drink?
I have this one, thank you.
Oh. How's John these days?
John?
Your husband, Mrs. Reardon. His name is John, isn't it?
My husband's been dead nearly 5 years.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it must be... Well, this is very awkward.
That's all right.
5 years. I could have sworn it was just 3 years ago I met you and John. In Denver.
It couldn't have been. We were never there.
Oh, well, pardon me. I sit here making bad conversation with you, and it's very apparent you're distressed. Look, I'm very sorry I upset you. Is there anything I could do?
No. No, Mr. Dolly, you didn't upset me. You look like a very nice person. How long are you going to be in Baltimore?
A few more days.
Perhaps you'll come out to the house for a drink before you go back. Say tomorrow.
Oh, I'd like that, Mrs. Reardon.
You can call me. I'm in the book.
Mrs. John Reardon?
Yes.
I will. Again, I'm sorry that I brought...
Do me a favor, Mr. Dollar. When you come to my house for a drink, call me Elizabeth. And please, don't mention my husband's name. I'd appreciate it very much if I never heard it again.
There'll be another exciting episode in our story of the Chesapeake fraud matter tomorrow.
Tomorrow, a little talk to a widow who might not be a widow at all. And a strong feeling that a smile can sometimes be more dangerous than a gun. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
What did we hear there, little
liar? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, The Chesapeake Fry Matter, Episode 1, original air date 17 of October, 1955. Up next, we got the six-shooter duel at Lockwood, 21st of March, 1954.
Okay. What are we listening to here?
WMFO, Medford.
Yeah, actually listening to the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford at Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks for listening.
In a moment, you'll hear James Stewart as the Six Shooter, just one of the many fine programs brought to you Sundays on NBC. Later this evening, listen to the NBC Star Playhouse with one of your favorite stars. Hear Meet the Press, America's number one newsmaking program. And be sure to keep tuned for the dramatic story of communism in America on Last Man Out. A wonderful lineup of great programs, all of them heard only on NBC. James Stewart as the Six Shooter. The man in the saddle is angular and long-legged. His skin is sun-dyed brown. The gun in his holster is gray steel and rainbow mother of pearl, its handle unmarked. People call them both the Six Shooter. The NBC Radio Network presents James Stewart as the Six Shooter. A transcribed series of radio dramas based on the life of Britt Ponsett, the Texas plainsman who wandered through the Western territories, leaving behind a trail of still-remembered legends. Now, in just a moment, you'll hear Act One of The Six Shooter. But first, I want to be sure that all of you know that beginning next week, we change our day and time of broadcast. Instead of Sundays, we'll be on the air Thursday evenings. In other words, our next Six Shooter program will be broadcast Thursday, April 1st, and every Thursday thereafter. For time of broadcast, please consult the listing in your local newspaper. We hope you like our new Thursday evening time. Now, Act One of The Six Shooter, starring James Stewart.
Wes? Wes!
What are you hollering about, Jim Cassidy?
I'm looking for Wes, Miss Singer. You know where I can find him?
Lockwood, maybe.
No, ma'am. He ain't in town this morning. I just come from there.
The jail in Lockwood. That's where he might be.
Now, Miss Singer, Wes ain't in jail no more. That's all over now.
All over?
Sure. And nobody's apt to try arresting him again, either.
They'll arrest him again, Jim, someday. Don't make no mistake about that. They'll arrest him or they'll kill him.
We all gotta go sooner or later, Granny.
Oh, Wes,
but if I was as close to my time as you are to yours, I wouldn't be talking about killing and dying so much.
Your time's closer than you think, Wes. Maybe even closer than mine.
Doggone it, Wes. She told me you wasn't even to home.
Ah, Granny's getting cantankerous in her old age, that's all. Well, what do you want?
Nothing special. I just thought maybe you'd like to know Britt Ponsett's in Lockwood.
Ponsett?
Yeah. He's staying at the hotel.
Well, why didn't you say so before?
Well, what's the difference? You wasn't serious the other day. Why, Wes, you couldn't have been. He's the Six Shooter.
You'll find out whether I was serious or not. I'll be in Lockwood at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Maybe Ponsett will be gone
by then. He won't leave. Not if he hears I'm coming in to pay him a visit.
You mean you want folks to know what you're aiming to do?
Sure, why not?
Well, Sheriff Hittleman ain't gonna like the idea. Well, he made that plain enough last week.
You think I'd let Ben Hittleman get in my way? Well, I'll grant you it wouldn't mean much, killing an old geezer who should have been put out to pasture 10 years ago.
Wes, you
But
can't...
if he asks for it, I reckon I'll have to oblige him. Now go on, spread the word. We ought to draw a good-sized crowd, the six-shooter and me.
Well, as soon as we'd finished fencing in the last couple of thousand acres on the Tip Top Ranch, old man Jeffers sent me into Lockwood to get some signs printed up. He wanted everybody to know that he owned the biggest spread in this part of the state, and he figured posting these signs every quarter of a mile or so would do the trick. Of course, the wording had to be just right. He wrote it all down so I wouldn't forget it. Tip Top Ranch, property of Rex Jeffers. Keep out. This means you. Trespassers will be shot at sight. If you ain't able to read this notice, keep out anyway. Rex Jeffers means what he says. Signed, Rex Jeffers. It's Thursday night when I got into town and the office of the Lockwood Clarion was closed. But first thing Friday morning, I headed over to give Pete Drum the order. Pete was the owner of the Clarion.
What in thunder is Rex thinking of, Britt? Folks all know the tip-top starts in and where it leaves off. Besides, I thought he had a fence around it now.
He has, but I guess maybe Rex feels that ain't enough.
Oh, 2,000 posters, just so we can see his name in print. All right, I'll do them. But it'll cost him $15, that's my price.
$15?
Can't be done for a cent less. Paper's expensive, Britt.
Well, how soon do you figure you can get at it, Pete?
Oh, I don't know. I got me a few more of these auction handbills and all. Then I suppose I can shift over to your order. Yeah, it's a good thing you're coming to town today.
Oh?
Monday I start getting ready for next week's paper. That ties me up clear into Thursday morning. And the way things have been happening around here lately...
Well, what do you mean, Pete?
Now, don't tell me that you ain't heard.
No, can't say I have.
Well, sir, Lockwood's got a brand new gunfighter.
Oh, gunfighter?
Just a kid, but he's faster than grease lightning. The first thing you know, Wes Singer will be just about as well known as Sam Bass or Bill Longley or any of the rest of them dead eyes.
Wes Singer?
Uh-huh. 2 killings in less than a month. That's what he's got to his credit so far. Wyatt Barker. He was the first. Wyatt and Wes got into some kind of a mix-up over to Charlie Jensen's place. Well, sir, Wes beat him to the draw and pumped 4 shots into Wyatt's body before it even hit the floor.
You don't say.
And afterwards, he just stood around there and he waited for Sheriff Hittleman to take him in for questioning. Why, he acted like he didn't have a worry in the world. And as things worked out, he was right. There wasn't nothing the sheriff could charge him with, seeing as how Wyatt was already drawing his gun when Wes cut loose.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I guess that's enough of them handbills now. Yeah. Now, what happened to that paper you gave me, Brett?
Oh, that?
Well, you know the wording on it for your posters?
Oh, here it is. Right here.
Yeah, thank you. Let's see. I suppose Rex Jeffers wants his name in the biggest type I've got.
Yeah. Yeah, I reckon he'd like to have it stand out good and plain.
Oh, yes, he would. Well, I guess this'll have to do. It was big enough for Lincoln's assassination. It ought to be big enough for Rex. Anyhow, like I was saying, folks just didn't know what to make of Wes Singer and the way he'd killed Wyatt Barker. They wasn't sure whether it was one of those times when a young fella just sort of flies off the handle and then settles down again afterwards. Or if Wes would take up gunslinging for a whole career. And about 10 days later, they found out.
Uh-huh.
It was on a Wednesday when he come riding down Main Street again. And we was all kind of curious to see how he'd behave, so some of us sort of moseyed over to Charlie Johnson's place when he went inside. And we'd no more than got there before he was in a mix-up with Todd Apple.
That's so.
Britt, I tell you, if I hadn't seen it myself, I wouldn't have believed it. Wes outdrew Todd by almost a full second. Now, you got to give the devil his due. Wes Singer is a fast man with a six-shooter. And I ought to know. I've seen the best. I've seen that gun of yours in action, Brett.
Well, that was some time ago.
Oh, you're still walking around on your hind legs? That's a pretty good sign you ain't completely out of practice.
Well, what about the sheriff? Didn't he arrest young Singer after the second shooting?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. He arrested him. Take a look at last week's clarion. Let's see. Oh, it's right there on the counter behind you there.
Hmm? Oh. Oh, is it Wes Singer acquitted? Jury finds Todd Apple killing was self-defense, huh?
Well, I guess they had to rule it that way since both men was armed, but Sheriff Hittleman, he sure didn't like it. He told Wes the next time he come into town stirring up trouble, he wouldn't be alive for no trial afterwards.
Well, Ben Hittleman's a man of his word. Singer ought to know that.
Sheriff ain't as young as he used to be, Britt, and he slowed down some these last few years. He slowed down a lot. Well, you take last winter when he went after Jake Gordon. If Jake's gun hadn't jammed, Ben wouldn't be here now. And believe me, Jake couldn't hold a candle to young Singer. Oh, no. Not a candle. Doggone it, what happened to that other cave? I was sure I had two of them.
Yeah, speaking of the sheriff, yeah, I think maybe I'll wander over and see how he's getting along. His office still around the corner?
Yeah, here? Same place as always.
I'll drop back and see you later,
please. Okay, Britt. But you take it easy.
Well, Lockwood never had been what you might call a real peaceful town. They'd had their share of gunfighters and shootings, no doubt about that. But Ben Hillman, he'd managed to keep things pretty well under control, so I figured he'd find some way of handling this Wes Singer. As I turned the corner, I got a little glimpse of Ben through the side window of his office. He was putting on his hat, getting ready to go out somewhere. George Pete was right. Ben had aged. Even more than I expected. He was carrying some extra weight and around his middle, too. Maybe that's what made him look shorter than I remembered him. His mustache had turned to kind of a brownish gray. Well, I opened the door and stepped inside, and for a minute or so, Ben didn't say anything. He just sort of stared at me, frowning. And then he sighed and took off his Stetson.
Hello, Britt.
Hi, Ben.
I heard you was in town. I'm just going to start looking for you.
Oh, well, I guess I saved you the trouble, huh?
Yeah. How long you figure on staying in Lockwood, Britt?
Well, the rest of the day, maybe part of tomorrow. Depends on how fast Pete Drum finishes up some printing he's doing for me. What's the matter? You anxious to get rid of me?
No. If you was to run off now, that'd turn him into a holy terror for certain. He'd say you left because you was scared of him. You know, holding him back after that.
Well, now, just what the Sam Hill are you talking about, Ben?
You ever hear of a fellow called Wes Singer? Lives out east of town?
Yeah. Pete was just telling me about him.
Well, it seems he's spoiling for a gunfight with you.
With me?
Yes.
Why, I never laid eyes on the man in my life.
Well, he knows you, at least by reputation.
Oh, huh.
He got to shooting off his mouth the other day, telling some of his pals how he could out-trigger any man in the state. One of the boys who was listening brung up your name, said he'd bet you could teach Wes a few things about slapping leather.
I see.
Of course, Wes had to back up his bragging. He told him if he was ever to come around Lockwood, he'd show him who was the best shot. He'd show everybody.
Oh, well, I imagine that's just so much talk.
At the time, maybe. But you're in town now. And if Wes don't do something about it, well, he ain't gonna look like much. Besides, you're kind of a tempting target, Britt.
Hmm? Well, what are you talking about, Ben?
You're the six-shooter, aren't you? Any young gunfighter who put a bullet into you, well, that'd give him a real claim to fame.
Oh, well, it's crazy, Ben. He doesn't have any cause to pick a fight with me.
They're all crazy, Britt. Gunslingers like Wes. The idea of getting killed themselves, it don't even enter their heads. If it did, they wouldn't be gunslingers. Well, you better get over to the hotel.
Hmm?
The word is Singer will get to town around 4 o'clock. I want you out of the way until I've finished with him.
Until you finish with him?
I warned him the next time he come into Lockwood and the prod, he'd have to answer to me.
Oh. You going to shoot it out with him?
If I have to.
You sure you can handle him, Ben?
Of course I can. No, Britt. No, I ain't sure. He's young. He's awful fast.
Yeah, that's what Pete said.
But I gotta try. And if it turns out that I ain't still man enough, well,
Aldous knew that sooner or later one of them would come along who was younger and faster.
Now, listen, Ben, you know, he's gunning for me, not you.
That ain't the point, Britt. I'm the one who laid down the law. Told him what I'd do if he ever tried to pull off another shooting spree.
Sure, I know.
So it's my job to stop him. Oh, you might be a better match for Wes. I don't deny that. And if he should get past me, not that he will, you understand, but if he should, well, then...
Yeah?
But I just couldn't step back and let you take him on first. Why, the folks would never pay no heed to me afterward. They'd say I'd talked big to Wes, but it was your gun he'd listen to. You see my point, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I see your point, Ben.
We'll return to James Stewart as the Six Shooter in just a moment. Be sure you're tuned to NBC Radio Thursday evening, March 25th, for the Academy Awards. At that time, you'll hear the entire Academy Awards ceremonies direct from the Hollywood Pantages Theater, where the finest artists in the motion picture industry will be assembled. Donald O'Connor will be your host, and during the evening, some 25 Academy Award Oscars will be handed to their new owners. It's Hollywood's most thrilling night of the year, jam-packed with glamour from beginning to end. And you can hear every moment of it when you tune to NBC. Right now, of course, the names of the Oscar winners are a highly guarded secret. A secret that any number of Hollywood actors, actresses, writers, musicians, and directors would love to know. Remember, it's a date with NBC Radio this coming Thursday evening. And that means be tuned to the station to which you're now listening for the Motion Picture Academy Award ceremonies directly from the stage of the Hollywood Pantages Theater. Now, Act Two of The Six Shooter, starring James Stewart as Britt Ponsett.
You sure couldn't blame Ben for feeling the way he did. He was the sheriff, and if Wes Singer came into Lockwood bound and determined to have another gunfight, well, Ben would just have to take a stand, that's all. And I sure didn't like the idea. A young fella I've never even met up with was gunning for me, and somebody else was going to try to hold him off. No, that's just didn't... Not that I was anxious to get mixed up with him or anything, but I just... Well... Anyway, as long as Ben had made up his mind, there wasn't much I could do about it one way or the other, at least for the time being. So I moseyed over to the hotel. The clerk stopped me as I was passing the desk. He pointed to a woman sitting on the other end of the lobby. He said she'd been waiting for me to come in. Elderly lady, white hair, wrinkled yellow face with a blue straw bonnet tied under her chin. Ma'am,
Yes?
My name's Ponsett, ma'am. Britt Ponsett. And...
Oh. Would you mind sitting down here, Mr. Ponsett?
Sure.
It's about Wes.
Oh, yes.
Wes Singer, that is. I'm his grandma.
I see, uh-huh.
You know what he aims to do this afternoon, Mr. Ponsett.
Well, I'd heard some talk about it, yes, ma'am.
It ain't just talk. He means it. He means to kill you.
Now, don't get too upset about it, Miss Singer. There's probably won't be any trouble between me and Wes.
What do you mean?
Well, Sheriff Hedelman will be waiting for him, and if Wes starts anything, he'll more than likely land in jail.
There ain't no jail could hold him anymore. And Ben Hittleman won't be able to arrest him again, neither. He'll shoot Ben without batting an eye.
I'm afraid I don't understand you, Miss Singer. I figured you were worried about Wes. I thought that's why you wanted to talk to me.
Worried about him? Well, I'm worried about all the men he's going to murder if somebody don't stop him. Men like Wyatt Barker and Todd Apple. Ben Hittleman, he'll be next.
Uh-huh. Well, just what is it you want from me, Mrs. Singer?
I want you to kill Wes. I want you to shoot him down like you'd shoot down a mad dog. You're the six shooter. You're the only one who'd have a chance against him.
Well, now, Sheriff Hittleman's the law in this town, Mrs. Singer. It ain't up to me.
Law? What kind of law is it that turned Wes loose after his other killings? He ain't fit to live, Mr. Ponsett. Maybe it's my fault he turned out the way he did. Maybe if his Ma and Pa had been here to raise him. But they wasn't. I'd done my best.
Of course you did, Miss Singer. Of course.
He couldn't have been born mean. The meanness wasn't in his blood. I don't know how it got into him.
Uh-huh. Well, sometimes it's pretty hard to explain a thing like that.
There's only one way he can end up. He'll be killed sooner or later. I'd even thought about doing it myself. Maybe it's my duty.
No, no, you shouldn't be talking like this, ma'am.
You've got to kill him, Mr. Ponsett. Today, this afternoon, before anybody else's blood is on his hands.
Well, now, I understand how you feel, Miss Singer, but my trying to kill Wes wouldn't... I just don't see how that'd be the answer.
Then what is the answer? I racked my brain. I asked God's help, done everything I could think of. What is the answer?
Well, I'm sorry, ma'am. I'm afraid I just don't know. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Mrs. Singer left the hotel. I watched her get into her buggy and drive off. She sat there stiff, tall, her eyes straight ahead, not looking one way or the other. And I waited until she dwindled down to just a little speck, and then I walked outside. There was a kind of a stillness in the air, like on a hot summer day just before a thunderstorm. The town was practically deserted. Nobody was in the stores, nobody in the street. Nobody but Ben Hittleman.
Britt, I told you to keep out of sight.
Yeah, I know, Ben.
Now, you get back to the hotel before it's too late.
I'm not waiting in the hotel, Ben.
What?
Now, I made up my mind. I've decided to take a little ride this afternoon.
A ride? What are you talking about?
Well, I thought maybe I'd head over that way, toward those hills over there.
And run right into Wes Singer?
Well, I suppose we might meet up if he's coming in that direction.
You know darn well he's coming from that direction. I told you he lives east of town.
Not of the think of it, I guess you did, yeah. Well, I'll be seeing you.
Now you listen to me, Britt.
Now, I have listened to you, and I see your point, Ben. If there's a gunfight here in Lockwood, or if it looks like there's going to be one, well, it's up to you to do something about it.
Well, ain't that what I've been telling you?
Sure, yeah. But on the other hand, whatever happens outside of town, beyond the city limits, that is, well, I don't see that that's any of your business.
Officially, no, but...
Well...
Britt, I won't let you do it. I know what'll happen between you and Singer. If you do get the draw on him, you'll hold off. You won't kill him. But if he gets the draw on you...
So long, Ben.
Britt!
I didn't ride very far, just a couple of miles. Then I reined up near a clump of spruce. Whoa, boy. Whoa, Scar. Scar wandered around nibbling at some tufts of dried up grass. I settled down in the shade to wait. About 10 minutes later, I saw him coming toward me. Not hurrying, just plodding along, slow, easy-like. Of course, I couldn't be sure that this was young Singer, but it seemed more than likely that it was him. And when he got close enough so I could see his face, well, there wasn't much doubt about it. He was young, all right. Appeared to be younger than his years, just a kid. Not a bad-looking boy, either. But there was something about his eyes and the way they kept darting from side to side like an animal on the prowl.
But when he saw me, he reined up and slid out of the saddle.
Howdy. You ride out here from Lockwood, mister?
That's right.
I hear Britt Ponsett's in town. Is that a fact?
He was in town.
Was? I might have known he'd run out on me. You got any idea which way he headed?
Yeah. I'm Britt Ponsett.
What?
That's right. There's something I can do for you. For a second, his eyes stopped moving and just stood there as if he didn't quite know what to do. But it didn't take him long to make up his mind. His right hand whipped down toward his holster so fast that it was all I could do to get hold of the shotgun before he finished his draw. And even then, it looked like he might just go ahead and squeeze the trigger, but he managed to hold himself back. We weren't more than about 8 feet apart, just staring at each other. His revolver aimed right at my face, and the shotgun I'd borrowed from Pete Drum pointing straight at his belly.
What are you trying to pull, mister?
How's that?
That shotgun. What's the matter with your six-shooter?
Nothing. Nothing at all. All right, go ahead. You've been telling everybody around town you're going to kill me. All right, go ahead. You couldn't miss me. Go on, you couldn't miss me, not at this range.
Sure, but...
But I'd still be able to let go with a blast, too, you know. Is that what you're worried about, Wes? And I guess it'd tear a pretty big hole through you.
I ain't afraid. You think I'm a coward, don't you?
I'll tell you one thing I think. You know, you never faced up to the fact that you might get killed in one of these gunfights of yours. As long as you got off the first shot, you figured the worst the other fella could do was just to nick you, if he was lucky. All right. Now, you can get off the first shot now. But if you do, I don't need to be able to aim this shotgun. I just couldn't help hitting you.
You're loco, Ponsett. We'd both be dead.
Yeah. Well?
You can't expect a man to commit suicide.
All right, I'm waiting, Singer.
You know there's no way to... You know I don't dare...
That's right.
But what do you expect me to do?
I expect you to put your gun away and get out of here. And you'd better not come into Lockwood again looking for trouble, because this isn't the only shotgun in town. Well, after a minute or so, he turned and he climbed on his horse. And I don't know for sure what happened to him after that. I heard that he moved on farther west and finally got into a gunfight with somebody who outgrew him. I guess it was bound to happen, of course. I just don't understand what gets into a fellow like him.
During this month before Easter, crippled children are making their annual appeal to you. They are appealing to you to continue to support the medical, therapeutic, educational, recreational, and vocational services which are indispensable to them. The services which are given by the Easter Seal Society in your community. Won't you answer the appeal of crippled children by...
That was the six-shooter duel at Lockwood. Original air date, 21st of March, 1954. And then here's the storm season emergency preparedness PSA. It's storm season with power, outrageous, and weather-related emergencies.
Outages. That would be outages.
More likely than the rest of the year. So be prepared. ahead of time by having a couple of gallons of drinking water and already stored in at least a few days worth of healthy, tasty, ready-to-eat food already stored in your home. Let other people scramble to the supermarket and wait on long lines while you safely ride out the storm from the comfort of home. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Okay, my name is Arthur, and his name is...
Little Arthur.
And you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Little Arthur, what's the next program we're playing?
Our next program is going to be Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, The Chesapeake Fraud Matter, Episode 2, original air date, 18 October, 1955. Thanks for listening, everybody.
From Hollywood, it's time now for Bob Bailey as...
Johnny Dollar.
Pat Gallagher, Universal. How'd you make out with Miss Reardon?
I met her. She thinks I'm an insurance broker or something. I told her I knew her husband when he was alive.
Industrial hazard lying. Part of the business, John. Did you find out anything that'll help you?
I found out she's pretty upset about everything in the world.
That's the only report you have for Universal Adjustment Bureau?
Oh, she invited me for cocktails. I'm going to call her later this afternoon and keep the date. Maybe I'll get some information then.
Cocktails, say? You made out okay.
Oh, shut up.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Universal Adjustment Bureau, Baltimore, Maryland. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Chesapeake fraud matter. Expense account item 3, $23.60, long-distance telephone call to George Hanley in Denver, Colorado. George is an old friend of mine in the private detective business. I told him about the report that John Reardon was still alive and living in Denver under the name of Frank Bowers. I requested him to gather information that would help in determining whether Bowers was really John Reardon or not. I spent the remainder of the day reading over the facts of the case as supplied to me by Pat Kelleher of Universal Adjustment. Expense account item 4, 10 cents, another phone call. This one to John Reardon's widow.
Hello?
Mrs. Reardon?
Yes.
This is Johnny Dollar.
Oh, yes, Mr. Dollar. You're the man who used to know John?
Yes.
I asked you over for a drink. I hope you're coming.
What time?
7 would be fine.
I was at her home at 7 o'clock, knocking on the door. It was a nice home, and she seemed like a nice person. Even nicer than the night before.
I asked you to call me Elizabeth, Mr. Dollar.
I remember. Yes, you also asked me not to mention your husband's name.
I wish you'd forget that. I was upset last night when we met. Forgive me. How's your drink?
Not swell.
I don't know why, but I feel I should explain myself a little more about saying what I did about John. I was very shocked at his death. I suppose I still am, even though it was 5 years ago. It always disturbs me when I'm reminded of it. Yet it's good to be reminded, I suppose, to know that he really is dead, that he won't come through that door anymore, that he won't telephone me from the office or make any plans with me. Does that make sense?
I suppose so.
Oh, we can drink another one. Sometimes things make more sense with a few drinks.
Sometimes they don't make any sense at all, Elizabeth.
That's right, too, Johnny. You know, I like you.
I like you.
Tell me about your business. You said insurance?
Yes.
You're a broker?
Well, not exactly.
A salesman?
No. I'm an investigator.
That must be terribly interesting work. I suppose you travel everywhere. Have you ever been to...
She had a nice mouth. Soft, frank, wide-open eyes. A couple of times I was on the verge of telling her exactly what I was working on and why I was talking to her. But I didn't. Somehow I felt comfortable in the house. Over the drinks and music, we eventually got around to John Reardon. She told me of their 4 years' marriage that ended with his sudden death.
Gave me everything I could possibly want to have. Why do I tell you all this? I never talked to anybody about it.
Well, I don't know. Possibly because you just want to talk to somebody about it.
You're easy to talk to, Johnny. I was 19 when I was married. I'd never known another man. It was wonderful at first. Wonderful all the time, I suppose. I just wasn't grown up enough to realize it.
Can I ask you a question?
Surely.
Did you really love him?
Yes.
I'm not convinced.
Why?
Oh, just a feeling.
Well, I did. I'm not so sure he loved me. That's an awful thing to say.
No, I don't think so. It's probably been on your mind a long time. You don't know me from a load of coal, but we've sat here and talked an hour. I think I know you.
I think so, too.
You still seem very despondent about his death. Yet you aren't sure he loved you.
I loved him.
Oh.
Here I am explaining things again, I suppose because they sound so foolish. Once we both loved each other. Very much. But we kicked it away. We just didn't get along. He was out spending his money on other people, and I was taking up this pastime. Can you tell when I've had too much?
No.
Thank you. Thank you awfully. Oh, Hugh!
Elizabeth.
Johnny, this is Hugh Bryan. This is Mr. Dollar, Hugh.
Hello, Mr. Dollar. How's your drink, Liz?
Fine.
Now tell me again, who is this?
This is Mr. Dollar.
What's your business, Mr. Dollar? I haven't seen you around before. Obviously, you just met Miss Reardon, or you'd never, never start drinking with her.
I wouldn't.
No. That's true, Liz, isn't it?
He was a friend of John's, Hugh.
Well, that's nice. I don't think I ever heard him mention your name. I was a friend of his, too. As a matter of fact, his attorney.
Hugh, you don't have to do this in front of...
And since John is no longer here, I've undertaken to look after some of the problems he left behind him, as an old friend would. Elizabeth, say goodnight to Mr. Dollar.
Now, look here, Hugh.
Say goodnight to him. He's just leaving.
Maybe it's better right now, Johnny. Good night.
Do you want me to leave?
She just said it would be better.
I'll call you at your hotel. Good night.
Good night, Mr.
No, no, you still have something in your glass. Finish your drink.
Okay.
An old friend of John's. That's good. Very good.
It is?
She picked you up in a bar last night. I saw her. I was with her. You never knew John Reardon in your life. You have no business being here, and I don't like cheap opportunists invading her home.
Evidently, you can talk to her any way you want to, and she'll take it. Why, I don't know. But don't talk to me that way. I don't have to take anything.
You were just leaving, weren't you?
Hugh Bryan was a large, bristling sort of man with a smooth manner. I didn't like him, and he didn't like me. Expense account item 5, $18. Even cab fares, lunches, etc. in and about Chesapeake Bay, talking to the principals connected with the boat explosion death of John Reardon. One of these was Lieutenant Jack Halverson, United States Coast Guard.
You want some coffee?
If I have to go out in that wind to get it, no.
Make it right here for just such occasions. Just a sec, I'll plug her in. There.
Brother, someday.
It's nice in the summertime. Now, what can I do for you?
Tell me about the boat going down. You made out the report for the Coast Guard.
You mean the Sharpstone's boat?
Yeah. We have a reliable witness who thinks that one of the passengers, a man named John Reardon, didn't go down with it at all, that he's still alive.
You said you had my report. Those are the facts.
But you picked up three bodies. Why not the fourth? Why not Reardon's?
Well, we searched the bay for a solid week looking for his body. We used every piece of equipment at our disposal. We did everything we could.
But you didn't find him.
First you come in here complaining about our weather, now you're mad about the way we were on the Coast Guard.
I'm sorry.
It's a very lousy-sounding apology. What do you want to find out?
How that boat exploded? Why you couldn't find Reardon's body if you found the others?
Now, look, if a bunch of rich jerks want to take a high-powered boat out and they don't know the first thing about high-test fuel or engine running, they're doing it at their own risk. That help?
Yes, some. I wish you could have put it on the report.
That's my ideas, buddy. The report just has the facts. Now, for the other, about finding Reardon, I don't know why. He blew up, went down, or drifted out to sea. If his body had been in the bay, we'd found it.
Was there a chance he might have survived and been rescued?
All we had left of the boat was pieces of wreckage, and if he was rescued, it was never reported, and I wouldn't know about that.
Could that have happened?
Sure. I could be an admiral tomorrow, too.
It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I got to Elizabeth Reardon's house.
You?
Hello, Mr. Bryan. Is Mrs. Reardon in?
No.
Then I'll wait. It's important that I see her.
I thought I made it clear to you last night I didn't want her being molested.
You did make it clear and cruel, Mr. Bryan. Now, I'm here...
Any business for her comes to me first.
I'm an insurance investigator.
I know that. She told me.
But she didn't tell you because she didn't know, and I didn't want her to know, that I'm working on a case that involves her.
What?
I have a report that her husband might still be alive.
Come in, Mr. Dollar.
I'll have to admit that Hugh Bryan's concern was as genuine as his surprise. He led me into the house and we sat at the bar. Only this time, no one had a drink. He listened while I told him about the report of Paul Coombs, that John Reardon was living in Denver under the name of Frank Bowers.
Do you think there's any truth to him?
It doesn't matter what I think, Mr. Bryan. I have to investigate it.
Yes, of course. And if he were alive, it'd be the best thing in the world.
Would it?
Of course. She's been lost without him all these years. She needs him, Mr. Dollar. She always needed him. This little bit of drinking has been going on too long. These tearful little episodes with one man or another. Oh, yes, I mistook you for one of those last night. I apologize for that sincerely. Actually, Mr. Dollar, she's been quite a task.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe I better talk to her now.
Do you have to?
There's certain information I'd like to get. I think she's the only one who can give it to me.
You'll have to tell her about the report?
Yes.
And there's probably so much talk. But it'd give her a terrible kind of hope. All right, I'll get her. No, you'd better mix one for her. She'll need it.
Wait a minute.
Yeah?
I need vital statistics on Reardon. Pictures, handwriting samples, everything. Could you help me gather them?
I'll do anything I can.
Well, then there's no need to bother her, is there?
You're a gentleman, Mr. Dollar.
I don't know why.
I do. You don't want to hurt her any more than I do.
An hour later, I was back in my hotel room. The next day, I had an appointment to meet Hugh Bryan and get all the material I had asked for. I was more depressed than ever about the case. About then, the phone rang. Johnny Dollar.
Johnny?
Yes.
This is Elizabeth Reardon. Please. Please don't look for him.
What?
Just forget it.
Did Hugh Bryan tell you what I was about?
I overheard you two talking. Don't bother with it. John's dead and that's that. Promise me. Promise you won't do anything else.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth. I have to investigate it.
Johnny, is that final?
I'm sorry. I don't have any choice. Elizabeth? Elizabeth?
That was yours truly, Johnny Dollar, the Chesapeake Fraud Matter, Episode 2, original air date, 18th of October, 1955, with John Denner.
No, I think that's John Danner. I can't be sure.
Probably is.
All right. Sure as heck sounds like him.
Yep.
Okay, you've been listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Anything to say, little Arthur, before we sign off?
Yeah, have you guys seen the new Green Line train?
Okay, we'll just leave it at that.